Issues, Etc., regular guest Pastor Stephen Parks on why your congregation should join the Issues, Etc. 300.
If I could, I'd just like to challenge any Lutheran pastors that are listening to consider becoming one of the congregations that supports Issues, Etc. My own congregation is a very small church, and I know it can be difficult to try and budget $1,000 a year to become one of the Issues, Etc. 300. But if you're being blessed by this, as I know you are, and if your congregation is being blessed by this, as I know that it is, I submit to bring it to the congregation to prayerfully consider supporting the outreach of Issues, Etc., not only here in the United States, but also around the world. Thank you so much for what you do.
Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. to your congregation's mission or advertising budget. Simply go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues, Etc. The Issues, Etc. 300.
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institute has today decided to award the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine 2010 to Robert Edwards for the development of in vitro fertilization.
Well, you're hearing there the Nobel Prize being awarded to a man who's had, I think in medicine, perhaps the greatest influence in the last three decades for in vitro fertilization. But has the influence proven to be for us good or ill? Has in vitro fertilization brought us, well, it certainly brought people a measure of increased satisfaction, assurance, and happiness. But what else has it brought us? Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc. Live this Thursday afternoon, the 7th of October. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We are coming to you live. You can join us for the next hour. 1-877-623-MYIE. 877-623-6943. You can send us an email right here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or you can also visit our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse will be our guest for the first few minutes of the program. We'll talk about in vitro fertilization and what it has wrought among us. A little bit later, audio open lines. Bill O'Reilly and Bill Maher went head-to-head on the subject of religion. It was a conversation, a little bit of a debate. They talked about the Bible and what it teaches. And Bill Maher, a famous popular comedian and atheist, raised a lot of the typical objections about the Bible, about our so-called holy book. We're going to let you listen to that conversation and then get your reaction during audio open lines here in about 10 minutes. On Issues, Etc. 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE. Talk back at issuesetc.org. You can leave your questions and comments on Bill O'Reilly versus Bill Maher on religion at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse is founder of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason universities. She's author of the book Smart Sex and Love in Economics. Jen, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
It has been with us for three decades. It is hailed as perhaps one of the greatest medical breakthroughs in that time, and many people have benefited from it. Has it been all benefit, in vitro fertilization?
Well, we just gave the Nobel Prize to Dr. Frankenstein here, the ability to create human life in the laboratory, and you know, it hasn't been an unmixed blessing. And the real question that in vitro fertilization raises for us is the question of whether our advances in technology are going to create a more human and humane future for us, or whether it's going to make it almost impossible to have a human future, whether we're going to be dominated by our technology or whether we're going to be intentional about what we do with it. So there have been any number of ethical problems and even economic problems, you could say, that arise from the widespread use of in vitro fertilization. So it's by no means an unambiguous good, let's put it that way.
Let's talk about the ethical problems. Be specific. Where would you begin in kind of saying, here's an ethical dilemma that we would not necessarily be facing or failing to face, as the case may be, were it not for in vitro fertilization?
Well, okay, you know, where do we begin? I mean, first of all, even in the citation for the Nobel Prize, it said that that from 20% to 30% of fertilized eggs achieve a pregnancy that is viable, or that a baby is born out of 20% to 30% of the fertilized eggs. Well, so that means between 70% and 80% of the procedures result in the death of a human being. Okay, a fertilized egg, that means a human being. Let's be real clear about that. And so 70% to 80% of them die. That's not usually considered a good success rate. You know, a medical procedure where 70% to 80% of the patients die. You know, that's one problem. Second problem is that we're manufacturing persons rather than seeing persons as gifts, a gift from God, you know, a gift in which we participate in procreation, but we're not actually the creators, where a person is begotten, not made. In that world, the world of our fathers and mothers, if we could put it that way, when children are begotten, not made, they're on equal moral and ethical status with their parents. Now what we have created is a world where one generation manufactures the next generation for purposes of its own. And when somebody is made, not begotten, what it means is that the object made is inferior to its maker, or is viewed as inferior to its maker. And that's why we tolerate that 70% to 80% failure rate, because we think they're not as good as us. We think they're not as important as us. And so how you're going to sustain a world that embraces human dignity and equal rights for all and equal dignity for all, when you're just literally discarding people at this rate, I don't see how you can do it. And we're changing our thinking day by day. People are becoming jaded about this. People are becoming people aren't taking it seriously anymore, if you see what I mean. It's like everybody accepts it. It's no big deal anymore. And so there's a way we're becoming callous to what we're doing in the lab.
What about removing step by step the procreative act from the birth of a child?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's go down that path too for a minute. When you started this question, my only question was where to begin with the problems, you know, the ethical and moral problems. I mean, what we're doing here is we're saying that a person can be become a parent without ever having any even remote relationship with another human being, so that a person can be brought into being without their parents ever having any kind of relationship or knowledge of one another whatsoever. I mean, in the old days, you had to at least have a one-night stand. There had to be at least a conjugal act performed at least once. And now that's not true, you know. And you can say all you want to about soldiers marching through a town and leaving abandoned babies behind them, and we know, we recognize that as a terrible thing when men father children and then just disappear. We recognize that as a terrible thing. But when a woman takes it on herself to have a child without a father, we're saying that's all great, that's all wonderful. But the impact to the child of being fatherless, that is the same in either case, you know. The difference is that in one case, the mother had no intention ever of having a relationship, and embraced that, chose that for her child there would be no relationship between the child's parents. And so we're removing procreation from the act of love, you see. And really and truly, when you think about the natural way of procreation, what you're looking at is that as the result of an act of love, a new being comes into being, a new person comes into being. And that's a beautiful thing. That's a wonderful thing. And you know, and we know that human beings being what they are, that doesn't always happen perfectly, and that doesn't always people don't love each other as much as they should, and so on and so forth. But that fact, no excuse for completely retreating from human relationship. And that's what IVF is really doing. The people who are using IVF without a partner are people who are in full-fledged retreat from human relationship. There's no question that IVF has made this possible.
One other term that I'd like you to react to with about a minute and a half here, Jennifer, and that is spare or surplus embryos.
Yes, yes. That's the other moral nightmare. That I was looking around in anticipation of this interview to find out how many we're talking about. The best estimate that I'm seeing right now is that there are about 500,000 frozen embryos in the United States, and that means human life, human beings that are in a state of preservation. They're frozen. They're not able to grow. They're not able to have a life, you know. And they're waiting for somebody to do something, you know. And couples that that use IVF end up quite often having these quote unquote spare embryos, and then they don't know what to do with them. They have all the children they think they can handle, and they don't. So they don't want to have more children. They don't want to give birth to the children, but they don't, also don't want to just flush them down the toilet either. And so they can't bring themselves to either discard them completely, or give them away, or let somebody do research on them. And that's why these spare embryos are sitting out there, because their parents understand them to be human and are reluctant to really dispose of them as if they were nothing but a clump of cells. The parents themselves don't want to do that. And so it's really illustrating that we have gotten ourselves into a sort of an intellectual cul-de-sac that we can't get ourselves out of. Because we want this so badly, we are willing to go forward with IVF. But in the end, the very thing that we want the most is another human being, and so we can't bear to bring ourselves to face up to what we've done, that we've got little human beings frozen waiting for somebody to do something with them.
Folks, I want to hear from you. What do you think about IVF, in vitro fertilization? Can it be done, if it's done better than it is now, in a way that avoids these ethical hurdles? 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse will be with us for a few minutes on the other side of this break to continue our conversation on in vitro fertilization. She's founder of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the book Smart Sex and Love and Economics. 1-877-623-MYIE. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc. After a few more minutes with Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse, it's going to be audio open lines. We'll play for you a conversation, a debate, if you will, between Bill O'Reilly and Bill Maher on religion, and then I want your reaction. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. More on IVF with Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse after this. We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology, and we'd like to send you an Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology, the Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7, 618-223-8384.
An umbilical cord of biblical truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. live on most smartphones? Just go to the Listen Live page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the smartphone link, and you can listen on your smartphone weekday afternoons between 3 to 5 Central. Old theology, new technology, Issues Etc. now broadcasting live to the world on most smartphones. Issues Etc. issuesetc.org.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
We knew for the first time that science and medicine had entered human conception decisively, and that from now on we would look at illnesses and diseases and other disorders in embryos as part of medicine.
It's Dr. Robert Edwards, pioneer of in vitro fertilization and recipient of the Nobel Prize in Medicine. We're talking about in vitro fertilization. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is our guest. Let's go to the phones. Greg is listening in Birmingham, Alabama. Greg, thanks for waiting. Greg, welcome. All right, we'll get Greg back here in just a moment. Jennifer, let's talk a little bit about the judicious, or the, shall we say, the prudent use of in vitro fertilization. We've had guests on the program before who have said, look, it's in and of itself, the technology can either be used or misused, and part of the problem that we're facing here is a technology that is often, and in, for the last 30 years, been misused. It has been something that we haven't given a thought to extra embryos. We haven't given a thought to surplus embryos or what we do with them, which is why we have this big so-called surplus. And nowadays, with embryonic stem cell research, there are all sorts of macabre ways that people are suggesting that we deal with this. The answer seems to be, in the minds of some, to do this prudently, to do this in such a way that the spare embryos are not produced, to do it in such a way so that we're not subjecting these spare embryos to the macabre designs of researchers. Can we, Jen, can we do this, in vitro fertilization, responsibly and ethically?
Well, you know, I suppose in principle it would be possible to avoid the destruction of the embryos, but I don't think that addresses the further set of questions that IVF raises, and that is the question of, is it quote unquote necessary to fertilize an egg outside of the human body through artificial techniques? When is that quote unquote necessary? Well, it's necessary because someone wants to do it, and for some reason, either medical or social, they're not able to achieve a pregnancy in the normal way. And so where is it written that we're entitled to have each and everything that we want? You know, why is it that this desire is something that we're entitled to fulfill? Rather than looking at it and saying, you know, this isn't meant to be. And I say that as a person having been through 4.5 years of infertility. And so I know how painful that can be, and how difficult it is for your sense of yourself as a woman, how difficult it can be for a man's sense of himself as a man to be unable to achieve a pregnancy with your spouse. But the idea that it's somehow medically necessary, it's not necessary. See, we deem it necessary because we want it so bad. And we're saying implicitly, or maybe even explicitly, that what we want, what I want, is the standard of what is good, and that there is no ethical reality apart from my wishes. That's a very dangerous universe we're creating there.
I mean, haven't we learned that with that, as you say, dangerous universe of way of thinking about our ethical choices, haven't we learned that it never stops with, well, you know, this might be iffy ethically,
right,
but we'll take a chance. There's always a greater ethical dilemma that faces us on the other side. The results of these things, the consequences, continue to give us taller and taller ethical mountains to climb.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And you see, the problem is this. See, right now, I don't know of anyone who knows the answer to the following question, Todd, okay? The question would be, of the people who are using infertility treatment, how many of them are married couples with medical problems? And the answer is no one knows. Literally, no one knows what percentage of people using infertility treatments are, in fact, married couples with medical problems. Many people using infertility treatments are unmarried women who do not have a partner at all, or often they're same-sex couples. So those are people who are saying, I am entitled to a child even though I don't have a partner of the opposite sex. Now, what creates that entitlement is what I would like to know. Where do we come to the conclusion that we're entitled to have a child? How is a child an entitlement? You know, that itself is, I think, a huge moral step to take, to say, I'm entitled to a child. In my opinion, no one is entitled to a child. Whether you're married or not, male or female, straight or gay, no one is entitled to a child. A child is not the kind of thing that people have entitlements to, you know? And that whole process of thinking process is taking us towards viewing the child as a commodity, viewing the child as objects. And the fact that people love their babies once they have the babies does not solve that basic problem of, is it really okay to say, I'm entitled to it? See, that does not answer the problem, does not solve the problem.
One other thing that concerns me, I'm sure you share this concern, Jennifer, is mid-70s it was in vitro fertilization, something that up until that time people said couldn't be done. There are a lot of things people are saying can't be done, and yet with every decade that passes, researchers in science and medicine shows us somehow it can be done. I'm concerned about what's next down the line, past in vitro fertilization, how much farther it may divorce the birth of children from marriage, family, father, mother,
right,
and all of that together. Your thoughts?
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, because we're separating procreation from an act of love. Okay, it's a technological act rather than an act of love. And even if the two people who walk into the infertility clinic love one another, that isn't the point, right? Their loving act is not what's creating the child, you know. And it's still the case that an individual can walk in to the clinic and perform a series of technological and commercial transactions and walk out with a child, see? And so you've transformed that. You've transformed the birth of the child from the result of a loving act into the result of a commercial and technological act. You've done something quite profound there. And so then the question is, what's next? Okay, once you say that people are entitled to manufacture other persons for their own purposes, what other purposes are going to be permissible? That's the first and creepiest question. What other purposes are going to be permissible besides the fact that I want a child to love? You know, there are plenty of people who have money who may want a child for some other purpose, right? And we don't have any way of knowing or stopping somebody from saying, you know, I want a child to experiment on. I want a child because I'm a pedophile and I want to have sex with a baby. I want a child because I want spare parts for a child that's already existing. You know, there really is no end to that set of questions, some of the problems that we're seeing now are really the tip of the iceberg. I mean, one kind of creepy thing that you sometimes see is women who are way past menopause deciding that they want to have kids. Right? That can be done now. Now, in what sense it is their child is a little bit iffy. Sometimes the older woman will be the gestational mother, the child will be planted in her womb, but it'll be somebody else's egg, somebody else's sperm, obviously, right? And so now you've got, you know, in some cases, women in their 50s or 60s even, giving birth to children, that how are they going to take care of that child? How's that 60-year-old woman going to take care of a toddler? What is it? What are we doing here? You know, what are we trying to say here? So what is at the end of the road is there are a lot of things that are at the end of the road. And to say that, well, we like what we're doing right now and we're going to just sidestep the ethical questions because, well, we're nice people and we wouldn't do anything mean, you know, that does not deal with a fundamental problem here, which is that you're setting something in motion whose end you cannot foresee. And I think what's really at the end of the road, Todd, is human cloning, of course. And human cloning is, rather than bringing another person into being as an act of love, human cloning is an act of pure narcissism. This is an act that's completely about myself, me, myself, and I, maybe quite literally, you know, me, myself, and I, me and my two little clones there, you know. And so we're radically transforming the way in which human beings relate to one another, not just around sex, but in general, you know, to start walking around the world with that kind of sense of entitlement, that's not a small thing to do to the human psyche, I think.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris is founder of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She's author of the book Smart Sex and Love in Economics. You find a link to her and her website under the Listen on Demand page at our website, issuesetc.org. Jennifer, thank you again for the extra time, and thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
When we come back, we're going to do a little audio open lines with you on this Thursday afternoon, October the 7th. We're going to be hearing Bill O'Reilly and Bill Maher, men of two very different political and religious persuasions, talking to one another about religion. Bill Maher's criticism of religious believers is they're just stupid. They believe stupid things. They believe inconsistent things. They suspend critical thinking and judgment in order to believe what religious believers believe. He has, you know, pretty open disdain for people like you and me. Bill O'Reilly wants to take him on. We'll see how well he does. We'll play the audio for you, and then we want to hear your reaction as well. It's Thursday afternoon, October the 7th. We are coming to you live, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can email us right here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc, or leave a question or comment for us on Bill Maher versus Bill O'Reilly at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. When we come back, audio open lines live this Thursday afternoon.
Would you like for us to post information about your congregation on the Find a Church page of our website? We'll add your church when it becomes part of the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your church's mission or advertising budget. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 at issuesetc.org. Click support and publicize your congregation to the world.
Do Lutherans just follow the teachings of Martin Luther? How is Lutheranism similar and different from historic churches like Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October is Lutheranism 101. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Lutheranism 101 by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Is it possible to be evangelical and Catholic? Lutheranism 101.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Examine your college bill closely.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The University of North Carolina requires all students to have health insurance. Those without are automatically enrolled in a plan and the costs added to their tuition. Pro-life students at UNC recently discovered that this policy covers abortions. It is unknown how long UNC has been doing this, but in August, pro-life students compelled the university to change its policy. Now, students may opt out of the plan that covers abortions. They are now pressuring the university to remove abortion coverage altogether, saying state funds and student fees should not be used to promote abortion.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.